Funding for the connection is made possible by the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, Jonathan Lear, is a sophisticated modern searcher who asks old-fashioned questions of the Socratic sort. What is human happiness? What does ethical virtue or the good life have to do with it? Why in our dark lives do we screw up so consistently? What do we do with the persistent intuition of higher powers, deeper drives, an invisible world of fantasy, myth, or spirit that seems to enclose us? The questions are common enough. What's rare about Jonathan Lear in today's world is that his answers about human striving come not in terms of evolutionary adaptation or brain function or serotonin levels, much less pharmacological remedies. He talks as the ancients did in terms of contemplation and understanding as answers to the question, how shall I live? He's a professional philosopher. He was the department chairman at Yale, who in midlife became also a Freudian analyst, so he also uses the ego and id labels that not many still do, the language of Oedipal instincts and death drives, as if they could actually still clarify our human situation. Happiness, death, and the remainder of life are the subjects of his new book of lectures. And the first question it could make you ask is, why in the world is he going back against the traffic to Freud, and even further back to Plato and Aristotle? Give him a call at 1-800-423-8255. The Happiness Connection phone is 800-423-TALK, or you can join us online at theconnection.org. Welcome back, Jonathan Lear. Your book and your whole mode reminds me of a series of 9 weeks we did last summer on philosophy, the examined life, all these rather grand questions. What startles me about the book, though, is the re-reverencing of the Freudian catalog as a way to go about it. Why have you brought all that back?
Well, I'm not sure I'm bringing it back. I'm bringing it back to attention, I suppose. I actually think these issues are much more part of popular culture than they're normally taken to be. I mean, we tend to think that Freud is dead. I mean, that's the common cultural cliche of the day. But I actually don't think he is, and I don't even think we really think he is.
We keep hearing he's dead, but we also wonder what in the world was that id all about, and what was the use of slapping that little Greek, you know,
well,
name on the complexities of who we are?
Well, I mean, Freud firstly didn't use that term. He used German the whole way through, and it's a Latin term, id. But he was talking about a certain part of ourselves that we don't fully understand, but keep sort of hitting us and coming to attention whether we like it or not. And I do think this is what relates the ancient Greek philosophical effort to sort of think about the nature of life and the meaning of life and what would be to make a happy life. Part of what they were all concerned about was interruptions to that project and why, given that we can think about our lives and would like to be happy, why are we always sort of tripping ourselves up? And I think Freud is just sort of developing on in that sort of tradition of trying to figure out what it is about ourselves that makes us interrupt ourselves in ways we don't understand.
It's certainly a great question.
Yeah. Sorry, what's that?
I mean, why are we always tripping ourselves?
Well, yeah, exactly. Why did we put Socrates to death? I mean, that was Plato's question. You know, what was it about his asking of those questions that led to a democratic vote of putting, you know, the person Plato thought was the best man to death?
Why do we do it? Not, I mean, I say,
why do we do what?
put Socrates to death.
Well, why do we? I mean, it's interesting. I mean, let me ask you. I mean, why do we form group ideas that certain things are important, or certain things are dead, or certain things are dangerous, or certain things are old hat? I mean, there are plenty of criticisms one can make about Freud and, you know, the man and Freud, his ideas. But one of the things that, you know, you sort of said something at the beginning about me going against the traffic, and you know, I think there's a personal dimension. I think wherever the traffic was going, I'd be thinking about what's going in the other direction. But there's a question about why does the traffic move so easily in one direction rather than another? What is it to make a crowd move one way? Is it really, you know, it is true that it's a cliche of the day that Freud is dead, but how many of the people sort of being so sure that that's true have really thought about it, read Freud, read, you know, it's crowds form. people form crowds, and that can be, you know, sometimes that can be a very nice thing, but sometimes it can be quite a dangerous thing.
Go back to the book. In the biggest terms, it's an argument, really, about Aristotle's definition of happiness and what makes the good life, counterposed against a Freudian take on it. And you say, in large measure, that they both missed the target.
Well, what I talk about is a attempt, and this is what I think links these, at least from some perspectives, looks like very different sorts of interests. But I think really Socrates lays down this concern about what is it to think about our lives taken as a whole, and what would it even mean to do that in the midst of life, given we can't take life as a whole in the same way we can, you know, take a bag off the shopping, you know, there's a shopping mark as a whole. There's something, we're in the midst of it. We don't know how long it is. We don't really even know how to go about considering what it would be to take our lives into consideration. And it's this set of concerns that, you know, we humans are different from other animals and that we can think about our lives and think about what to do in respect to them. And that leads to a lot of thinking about, well, I mean, this is Socrates' point, that we life would be better. In fact, it is the best life to be able to think about life and to think about how to live that life. And the question then arises, well, how do you go about doing that, and what problems are there? And I think, you know, what both Aristotle's two generations later than Socrates, he's trying to work out an idea that Socrates begins, which is we can think about our lives as an attempt to be happy, as a striving towards happiness. And again, Freud, I think, tries to do a kind of interesting inversion where he says, well, it may not seem that way, but really, if we think about what humans are striving for, it's a very cryptic claim, but I'll just say it, they're really striving towards death. But in both those cases, there's an attempt to sort of say what this principle is that humans are aiming towards, what's the nature of striving in a life. And I think my book is an attempt to say that, criticize the idea that we can give one totalizing principle to say that it's that, whatever it is, that humans are striving for. And in that sense, I compare Plato with Freud, Aristotle and Plato with Freud, in attempts to come up with a single principle that human striving is a striving towards. And I think one of the things I'm interested in is I think a deeper reading of psychoanalysis shows that there's a kind of inherent self-disruptiveness to life that can't be assumed under any principle of striving, but it's there disrupting our lives, whether we like it or not, and for better and for worse.
In us or outside us? The principle of disruption?
Both, but inside us. Yeah, that the human mind itself is a self-disrupting organism, for lack of a better word. Yeah.
You bring both Freud and the Greeks, Aristotle and Plato, back to Plato's myth of the cave, of people living inside a world of shadows, only dimly aware of the bigger truth enveloping them. How does that work in your own sort of resolution?
Well, one of the things, it's a very interesting account. I mean, the cave is probably the most famous metaphor of Western philosophy, Western metaphysics. And one of the things it's trying to account for is, given that the world is basically a good place, why are things so bad? And the image is that there is this sort of the form of the good is outside the cave, that we're just sort of locked as prisoners inside the cave, looking at shadows on the wall that we take mistake for reality. We're sort of trapped in our own illusions and fantasies. And, you know, although it's quite a dark image, it's a very hopeful image, I think, because if you think about it, you realize, firstly, there's no active principle for evil in that world. All the mistakes, all the badness, I mean, putting Socrates to death, it's because we're falling at some distance from goodness. And so Plato is actually trying to explain badness in the world, and you might say evil in the world, by talking about a distance from what's good rather than any active principle of evil. Similarly, all irrationality, I mean, one of the things he's trying to explain is why and how people do irrational things like kill Socrates. All irrationality is always done in Plato's universe under the aspect of trying to do something good.
Yes.
Now, bad people may be doing bad things, but they think they're doing a good thing in Plato's world. Everybody thinks they're doing a good thing, and that makes sense. I mean, you meet selfish people. Selfish people don't think they're selfish. They think they're very reasonable. They're very, even people who are doing bad things think of themselves as doing something that's good or good for them. But I think one of the things that Freud discovers, and I don't think he's aware of it, that's part of what the book is about, is that there's a kinds of principles, principles is the wrong word, there is in the mind forces for disruption that cause certain kinds of irrationality that can't be explained just as a certain kind of desiring for an image of the good. And so the whole image of the cave, of an inside and an outside, and basically badness being the result of fantasies, that are distorted, I don't think gives a complete enough view of all the possibilities that there are.
You're interesting, Jonathan Lear. Your mind runs to philosophy and a kind of literary analysis, but you're also licensed practitioner yourself. How would you put these ideas, or how have you put them to use, both in your teaching, but more particularly in your treatment of patients?
Firstly, let me say, I saw patients for about 10 or 11 years, and I'm taking a break now. I'll see patients again in about another 2 or 3 years, but right now I'm not seeing patients. But I do think, I mean, in terms of, I don't want to get into too many details, but one of the things that I think is most striking about this, both in terms of, in all aspects, I mean, in terms of psychoanalytic treatment, in terms of teaching, in terms of life, is if there is a principle of I keep using the word, it's the wrong word, I mean, if there is an inherent tendency towards self-disruption in the mind, then there are going to be continually occasions of spontaneity and things breaking open in ways that are unpredictable and that just happen. And then there's a question, what do we make of it, or what does the mind make of it? So I think in terms of psychoanalytic practice, keeping an ear open for spontaneous moments of things opening up and breaking open. And I have this phrase about a possibility for new possibilities, that what's opening up is not a new thing, but a new field of possibilities that wasn't there before.
It's interesting, the kinds of people we talk with more often than not about how the mind works would immediately ask, wait a second, if there's a sort of principle of disruption built into the organism, us, what survival value might it have had? What would its evolutionary sort of adaptive service have been? Do you go down that road at all?
Well, I'm not an evolutionary biologist, and I'm not the person to speak other than totally anecdotally an armchair. But if I give all of that you might say, look, I mean, think about nature in general. This is the whole idea from some kind of evolutionary biological point of view. There's no point to the just brute natural fact that there are disruptions in nature. And then nature itself, you might say, tries to do something with that disruption. This would be a mutation by closing over it, mutating in relationship to it, trying to form a species that will reproduce to form its kind. It's like there was no principle or point to the disruption. The disruption just happened. But given that it happened, all sorts of new possibilities are opened up for nature to try and form new combinations and new forms of nature. Now, something analogous to that, I think, is happening within the mind. And it's the...
Hold the thought. We'll come back to it. Jonathan Lear is our guest. He's a philosopher and an analyst of the Freudian persuasion who teaches at the University of Chicago. And his new book is called Happiness, Death, and the Remainder of Life. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. We'll be back after a short break. This is The Connection. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about happiness, death, and the remainder of life with the writer Jonathan Lear, who's both philosopher and Freudian analyst. I think the question for listeners is really, who still puts value in the Freudian vocabulary, the language of the unconscious and repression in real life today, or as, in your daily life, in your love life, in your work life, but also in a big understanding of who we are and what constitutes happiness. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Jonathan Lear connection, or 1-800-423-TALK. What's your own take on the usefulness, again, of those words?
Well, one of the things I started to talk about as we were talking earlier at the beginning of our conversation was, you know, you said about Freud being dead and whatever. And when, I was just struck when I was reading, following the election coverage, where it seemed to me if you couldn't read the paper without feeling, at least from my point of view, I think if you pay attention, you'll see it for yourselves, that there was a tremendous hunger among reporters to talk about what are the unconscious meanings here. I mean, there was that, you know, that huge scandal with the, you know, the so-called rats word subliminally put in
right.
the... And then there's a whole discussion about what was the meaning of George W. Bush's slip of the tongue. And then one of the things that was so striking to me was there was a tremendous... It wasn't just the fact that both candidates went on to comedy shows, late-night comedy shows, but it was front-page news that they did so. And in fact... Saturday Night Live skits of the debates were front page news of the paper. And the reporters would say, really, when explaining why they were covering this, would be it's because the candidates are trying to get an unconscious or a hidden message across in jokes that they, you know, don't want to, you know, they can't do straightforwardly in a speech about what their ideas are. And in fact, they want to bypass people's conscious decisions about what policies are and sort of affect a more sort of less consciously articulated rapport. And then the reporters are very busy trying to figure out, well, what is the meaning here? So, in fact, and, you know, you only have to read Freud's essay, Jokes and Their Relationship to the Unconscious, to see that these reporters, I think, who were covering the election were struggling for a vocabulary.
It wasn't just the reporters.
Yep.
I mean,
yeah,
all
no.
of us. I mean, the meaning of a kiss, whether it was Al Gore's with his wife or his and W's with Oprah.
Absolutely. And the fact that, you know, there was an immense amount of both questioning among electors, but also, again, in the papers, what is the meaning of this, that these are two sons who are running? Their fathers
right.
were both prominent political leaders. These are sons who have the same names as the... as their fathers, and indeed, somebody, I think it was in the New York Review of Books, has pointed out all of the five major candidates for the nomination had the same names as their father. I mean, this was a year in which the name of the son was the name of the father. This intrigues people, and I think correctly. So the idea that this is just, you know, that I'm just sort of a museum director wheeling out an old exhibit and asking you to pay attention, I think is really not what things are really like.
1-800-423-8255 makes the, dare I say, neo-Freudian
there
connection
you go.
With Jonathan Lear and his new book, Happiness, Death, and the Remainder of Life. Let's not forget to get to the remainder of life, incidentally.
I'll get there.
1-800-423-TALK. Romero is on the line.
Hello?
Romero, welcome.
Oh, thank you. One comment that I had was... said something to the effect that what is the take on Freudian analysis in society today,
mm-hmm.
and that if it's diminishing or going away, and I feel like these types of ideas scare people, and probably in effect we're in retreat from these ideas.
Which one's Romero?
Well, the idea that we're in a cave and we're not really seeing what's happening. Most people don't want to even try to believe that that might be true.
Right.
And so I think down the road, perhaps, we'll start to come back to take these ideas to heart, because I believe that there is a lot of truth in those ideas.
Well,
Jonathan Lear.
Yeah, I find myself in, you know, basic agreement with what you said. There, one thing I do want to say is I think that psychoanalysis and Freud deserved a fair amount of criticism that they got. I mean, both Freud's treatment of some of his cases, I think, they're very much open for criticism. Some parts of the theory do seem to me, you know, very much overstated. And, you know, it's a feature of the success of the profession of psychoanalysis in the first half of the, you know, first, let's say, two-thirds of the 20th century that it overstated its claims. It said it could do things it couldn't do. And I think there was a very healthy and valuable correction that occurred. And along with it, you know, tremendous advances in neuropsychiatry and the ability to treat people who are suffering various forms of psychological pain with drugs, all of which I think are, you know, in themselves very good things. but it's also true that when something like that occurs, there's a tendency to, I think, go too far in the other direction, say, you know, we don't need Freud anymore, we don't need psychoanalysis anymore, we can do all of this with drugs. And I think here there is, this is where I think I agree with you most strongly, there's a wish that everything about us can be known, understood, treated as a technical problem or a technological problem and can be solved. Mm. And that, I think, covers over an anxiety about our being much more complicated creatures than we want to admit we are. And here, I think, this is where I think psychoanalysis is very important, remains so.
Except you transfer these kind of, you transpose these disruptive moments in your own language into moments of human possibility. You also, I mean, that's sort of the good news. You also say that as human beings, we have to tolerate a peculiar kind of theoretical anxiety. We have to develop a willingness, as you write, to live without a principle. Only then can we begin to grasp the peculiar possibility for possibilities that the human being opens up. Just what does that mean?
Well, it means, what it means is that in addition, it's not that we have no principles of mental functioning at all. Of course we do. The idea is we don't have principles of mental functioning that explain everything there is to know about mental functioning. And that part of what is happening, part of the psychoanalytic insight, I think, can be said as a very banal truth, which is that we live life under pressure. And we live life, mm-hmm. life is stressful, and second deep psychoanalytic truth, we often take it out on the body. Now, if life is pressured, if we do live under stress, and I think Freud took that very, very seriously with the idea of psychological energy, then there are moments, I mean, really chance moments, random moments of the energy being too much and things just sort of breaking open or breaking down, sometimes in big ways, sometimes in very little ways. And it's that. There's no principle of that. It's just, you know, it's like, you know, it's like a house with a lot of electricity surging through it and no circuit breakers and no fuses. Somewhere it's going to blow. But there's not going to be a predictable place where or how.
1-800-423-8255 joins the conversation with Jonathan Lear. Peter is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, Peter.
Hi. I'm fascinated by your conversation. And I have a question about how people make sense with the major disruption of life, particularly suicide or incompleted suicide. And that's been part of my experience over the past dozen years. And I've talked to a few people that I've met who've undergone kind of a radical life revision following an incompleted suicide. And this whole conversation about the energy towards life or towards death and how, you know, the energy, psychic, physical, hope, aspiration, despair kind of bursts through and how people make sense out of that kind of disaster and reassemble their lives. You know, either from your own clinical experience, I'd appreciate comments, or from a more philosophical aspect.
Peter, it's an interesting question.
Well, I think you raise a fascinating question, in bringing up in a way that's quite sad. And that's, I think, one of the things I really do want to emphasize is that the kind of disruption I'm talking about is, you know, I want to say it's like before good and evil. It's neither a principle or neither a force for good or a force for evil or bad. But it can occur in situations that are both very good, I think, and very bad, and also quite mixed, and also in various degrees. There can be these, you know, little moments where the mind just sort of has these little ruptures, and in fact things start to look very differently to you, and they can be used quite creatively. People who fall in love, I mean, I don't mean that sort of metaphorically, but like, bang, somebody just gets hit, and her life, his life is just completely different for that moment. The life will never be the same again, whatever possibilities then get opened up. But I do think that there are also these awful, horrific moments where the mind itself experiences is like a real serious trauma of itself coming apart or falling apart or just bursting open. And these moments are horrific. To the point that people do attempt to take their lives in them and around them. And these are, you know, these, and then...
Peter also asked how after a suicidal disruption or after for that matter, a deep love affair or experience.
Right.
How do you help people make sense of their lives again? How do you recover?
I mean, in the smallest nutshell, the hope is to get people. This is going to sound enigmatic at first, but the hope is to get people back where they can dream. Restore dreaming, but I mean dreaming in the largest and most broadest possible sense. Just as though, again, in nature, if you think about there being a disruption in nature, and then nature tries to heal over and form new forms of meaning, you might say, new forms of species that can live in this now disrupted nature. So the mind, when there's a disruption, and if it hasn't been too catastrophic to either destroy the mind or destroy the life, is in the business of trying to heal over. And healing over, what the mind is in the business of trying to do is make meanings, associate meanings, try and make sense of what happened, try and move on from here, try and be an imaginative and creative person, which involves making some imaginative and creative sense of what just happened. And that, I think, is what one does, both in life and in therapy. I mean, when it's working okay. And this is where, some breaks are catastrophic breaks, psychotic breaks. I'm interested also in what you might call lucky breaks, which are breaks which afterwards you can make something creative and meaningful out of in life.
Do dreams count?
Dreams are the paradigm of making meaning for me. It may sound odd, but dreaming is the mind, is the sort of love. I mean, maybe this is, I don't want to get us off on a tangent, but I want to say this imaginative activity of connecting things up in strange ways, one thing leading to another, going down all these paths full of energy and creativity and imagination. That's what I want to call dreaming, whether we're asleep or awake.
Fascinating. 1-800-423-8255. Michael is calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome.
Hello.
Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for taking my call. Love the discussion.
Thank you.
I'm calling. I guess I'd like to introduce the French philosopher Henri Bergson, and first start off by saying I'm not a philosopher. I'm an adjunct professor of architecture, and I guess the reason why I raise it is sort of a comment and a question. But I think in one of his master's thesis texts, he says something about, and I default to this frequently, idealism and realism both going too far. And as a professor of architecture, and also someone who practices, I find myself constantly engaging with the students at a level of what should they do, how should they live their life, what should they pursue, what should they dream of, and also as a very practical kind of realistic pursuit of the basic training of putting together buildings. And I guess at the college level, I would just wonder how that plays in, if it plays in at all to the discussion. Anyway, just toss it out there.
Well, thank you.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you very much. I have to tell you that one of the reasons I went to the University of Chicago is that when I drive from the university down Lakeshore Drive, looking at the skyline of the architecture of Chicago, it's one of the most beautiful things I've seen. And it's that right on the edge of the lake, it seems to me one of the things I love about Chicago is, it's the beautiful coming right up against the sublime. But I think you're right that that architects by their profession have to think about the whole, at least some kind of a whole, which is how is this environment going to be? How are people going to live in it? How is the whole, not just any particular activity in the building, but the building as a whole, how is that going to be? And how is it going to be amongst other buildings in a larger cityscape with human life as its point and end? And I think so. I think it is the same neighborhood of concerns. I would say it doesn't begin with Henri Bergson. This really is Socrates' question, which is there is a way we don't even understand yet, I think, what it is, but there is something about taking our lives as a whole into account in thinking about how to live and what it would be to live a full, meaningful, rich life. No other creatures can do that, and it has its problems as well as its possibilities.
1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with Jonathan Lear. Charlie's on the line.
Hi. I just have to say that Jonathan Lear is one of my true intellectual heroes.
Thank you.
His book, Love and Its Place in Nature, is really one of the best books ever written on psychoanalysis.
So thank you.
I greatly look forward to this one. I actually use it in a training program at Harvard as a teaching book.
So. Training for what, Charlie?
clinical psychology trainees for clinical psychology practice.
Well, I'm touched, Charlie. Thank you. I'm delighted.
What I wanted to ask you is whether you have elaborated any more your notion that was explicit in Love in Its Place and Nature of the healing nature of the relationship, and the healing nature of the relationship in regard to the more disorganized, defensive, person in struggle and suffering being somewhat healed by being in relationship to a more, you know, different, organized, structured, coherent presence that promotes growth and development.
Well, I do start to talk about that more, but I want to emphasize start. That's exactly an area in which I am currently working, and I hope to have more to say over the years. But I do want to say this. I mean, following up on what Chris and I were talking about earlier, so much of, I think, the therapeutic moment, I mean, when you think, those of you who are clinicians, or actually probably more importantly, those of you who are in various forms of psychotherapy or analysis, I mean, one finds that there are these long periods where, you know, things stretch out, stories get elaborated, the problems of life, the problems of intimacy get sort of elaborated and talked about, and there's more and more insight. But that creates an environment in which eventually there are what I call breaks, these things that sort of interrupt the whole story. Surprising things happen. There's a shift in the mind's working. And I think from a clinical point of view, these are moments in which it's very, very important for the therapist to have his or her ear open for that, because these are moments where I think whole new fields of possibility opens up for both of you, and they're there to be grabbed if you can hear them. And I do think that that's a, you know, clinically just a very, very important distinction between things just sort of getting elaborated, which are very, very important in itself, but these moments that occur of, you know, things breaking open. And I do talk about that in the book.
Charlie, thank you. You do indeed. And you talk about how a therapist sort of listen for the breaks, listen for the interruptions, the stray thought that becomes central. And you also sort of apply that technique in your own reading of Aristotle and of Freud. In the case of Aristotle, where you wonder if those manuscripts are complete, I have to wonder about the method. But I want you to come back in the ways to which you psychoanalyze the psychoanalyst. And are you with him, for example, about a kind of Oedipal connection of Judaism to Christianity to psychoanalysis? Our guest is Jonathan Lear. We're talking about happiness. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Jonathan Lear is our guest. Yes, he is a neo-Freudian. He's writing about happiness, death, and the remainder of life. You're a neo-Freudian, but you also sort of put Freud on the couch a little bit and turned him around. Where did he go wrong in your take?
Well,
in the big picture.
In the big picture, I think there's a point at which, I think in 1920, this article that I spend a fair amount of time talking about, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, I think when Freud is trying to grapple with these darker forces in human life, particularly the aggressive forces of human beings, he's trying to figure out what's going on there. I mean, there's much there that's of value and very, very does repay serious reading and thinking. But I think something goes wrong in Freud's. I mean, if I had to sort of say it in short as company as I could, is that I think Freud is addicted to principles. He wants to, you know, there's something quite wonderful about what he's doing and trying to find hidden meanings, and things aren't really like this, they're like that, and things aren't as obvious as they, as we often take them to be. There's a hidden agenda going on in human life and whatever. All of that, I think, is quite wonderful and fascinating. But there's a temptation in the way he thinks to think that you ought to be able to grasp all of that in a particular principle, unless he names the death drive in this particular case as a principle, which is going to be the thing that explains human aggression, for instance. And after that, from 1920 to the rest of his life, I mean, again, there's much there that is rewards careful study and thought. But he's willing, he's a kind of a thinker of a kind of a grand sort, and it's, I think it's a 19th century style, to start speculating about cosmic principles. I mean, he talks about the pre-Socratics and Anaxagoras and love and hate, and I think that kind of speculation, I mean, it's fun, and it's, but it actually does get in the way of really figuring out what's going on. And I think a number of his later speculations just are wrong, and I think they've just gotten in the way of psychoanalysis developing in the right sorts of ways.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Jonathan Lear connection. Harold is on the line.
I have no party pre one way or the other on the issue, but I was curious to know what Mr. Lear thinks of the, or would have to say, to the growing body of literature exemplified by Frank Chaffee and Frederick Morton Cruz and by Grinbaum that would suggest that at its best, psychoanalysis and its continuing tradition is no more than a pseudoscience with no more cogent claim on credence as a guide to life than the highly articulated psychologies developed historically by medieval moral theology, by Zeno and Chrysippus, and other ancient Stoics, by Spinoza in books 3 and 4 of the Ethics, and so forth. The difficulty with all these systems, prudential or wisdom systems, as explanatory enterprises, is that they seem to be, when you look at them with great, with a certain critical attitude, incoherent collections of gingered up folk wisdom and vague metaphors. Now, I'm not myself advocating I'm simply asking what he would say to that.
Well, I want to say that I think the critics of Freud, the ones you mentioned, in particular, I want to single out Adolf Grinbaum as having made, I think, very, very serious criticisms and very valuable ones, both not just of Freud, but of the psychoanalytic writing after Freud. And so I certainly don't want to say that that these criticisms are worthless. I don't. I think that there are many good ones that have been made by all three of the writers that you mentioned. And in particular, I think the claim that Grinbaum makes that if psychoanalysis is serious, it's got to be making serious causal claims about how the mind actually works, that Grinbaum is absolutely right about that. My diagnosis is that they move from a handful of criticisms, some of them extremely good, and I have to say some of them, I think, quite unfair. I do think some of the things that Cruz has written, not all of them, but some of them are just, you know, almost very distorted and unfair. But let's leave that aside. I think that they all move from the fact that there are serious problems, serious considerations can be made, to saying, some kind of mythical structure of some mythical system. I don't think that's a fair inference from what's been shown.
On the pseudoscience question, I mean, does it get Freud off the hook to treat him as you do, less as a scientist in the long run than as a philosopher?
No, I don't think that does get him off the hook. I think he ought to be on this hook, and he ought to be able to get off on his own, you know. I do think that there's a very important claim here, which is that the mind operates psychologically, which I mean ideas in the mind themselves can have and do have causal efficacy. And the second claim is that some of those ideas are unconscious, they have real causal efficacy, but we're not aware of them operating on us and in us. And a third claim, two more and I'll be done, is that the unconscious is actually repressed. There's a motivated reason we can't get these ideas to our conscious. There's a causal force that's keeping them from being conscious. And then the final claim, this is the most difficult one because it actually takes a lot of explication, and I'm not going to be able to do it, but that this has something to do with human sexuality, and that there's something strange and special about sexuality when you get into the human dimension. I think all those claims are Freudian claims. I think they're all true. And I also think that if they're wrong, then psychoanalysis is wrong, and it ought to be thrown out. It's because I think those are actually true that I am here today, and I don't think you can get them off. I think there's a lot of relevance, philosophical relevance, but only because those things are true.
Hmm.
How do you like that?
I like it. 1-800-423-8255, a man who sticks to his guns and knows what he thinks. Carl is on the line.
Yes, hello.
Welcome, Carl.
Hi, welcome. I just wanted to say that the issue of the correctness of Freud's claims is really not the same as a consideration of how correct the claims of the psychoanalytic movement in America particularly have been, because a lot of what Freud himself said, although parts of it are clearly mistaken, other parts of it are clearly correct. Some mm-hmm. of his insights about the meaningfulness of childhood experience, for instance, or the developmental nature of human development, the development of the personality, really can't be meaningfully disagreed with any longer. They've become part of our dogma. What people often disagree with when they disagree with what they think Freud is saying is the stereotypes of some of his positions, taking literally some of his metaphors, things of that nature. And in the long run, whether he was right or wrong probably doesn't matter as much as what value can he have for us in the future, and what kind of stimulation can we get by reading him today?
I couldn't agree more. I'll just say one more thing, which is in relation to what you have just said and also the previous caller, which is, you know, if you take any area of thought which you think is very respectable, take a, you know, let's say physics as a scientific, and you take a physicist, a top physicist of the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, however good, they're going to have said things that we no longer agree with today. That doesn't show that this is a, you know, total mythic whatever. It shows that, a body of thinking moves on and people are human and they make mistakes, and Freud was one of them. So, I mean, I basically agree with you. I do want to say, though, that, I mean, I'm teaching a course on the Dora case, actually about how to turn Dora into an opera with a person who's writing an opera about the Dora case. And every time I read that case, it breaks my heart. I've read it I don't know how many times, and there is somebody who Freud...
Walk us through
help.
It in two sentences.
I can't. No, it's breathtaking. Dora is brought to Freud by her father. And her father is busy having an affair with somebody whose husband is flirting with Dora. I mean, all the adults in Dora's world are conspiring against her. And Freud actually, you know, he's the one person who will listen to Dora and acknowledge the truth of her story, but gets caught up in his own what we would call transferences or countertransferences. And not only he doesn't help her, it's complicated, but it's certainly he doesn't give her the help that she needed. And that's it's heartbreaking to me every time I read it.
But it also bent his whole analysis for many years.
God bless him. I mean, the thing about him is that even though he botched the Dora case terribly, and I think, you know, she needed a lot of help he didn't give her, he realized he botched it. And although he writes in quite a, I think, self-serving way, he nevertheless mm-hmm. acknowledges that this was a failed analysis. And in meditating on his failure, his self-acknowledged failure, this is really the first time he comes to, you know, conceptualize deeply what he means by transference. And he acknowledges he missed the transference. He's right about that. The thing that breaks my heart is that she goes back later to see him, and I think she's basically asking for another chance. She ended the therapy the first time around, but she goes back later and sees him and basically asks for another chance, and he refuses. And he says that he basically knew that she wasn't really being serious, et cetera. And that's the moment that breaks my heart. I just I can't bear it.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Jonathan Lear connection. Mark is on the line.
Hello, Chris.
Hello, Mark. Welcome.
Mark Proctor here. May I say, with many others, your show is wonderful. It's a gift to everyone who hears it. I only have one beef about your show. Every time I hear it, I'm soon on Amazon.com buying books.
That's the stuff. Mark, thanks. It's good to hear from you.
I have one comment to make. I agree with Mr. Lear about the tendency mentioned just now being true. the point I want to mention is that aside from psychoanalytic treatment constituting a philosophical or scientific paradigm, there is one phenomenon that occurs in formal psychoanalytic treatment and in psychotherapeutic treatment more generally, and it's the phenomenon of empathy. I will sometimes mention to my patients that the human brain was not designed to work and operate in isolation from other human brains. And I think that's just a key idea, that the experience of one person's experiencing another person's empathizing accurately with their thoughts, their dreams, whatever, in and of itself, that experience of interpersonal empathy has profound, creates profound possibilities for the kind of things that Mr. Blair was speaking of.
You're pushing back toward the love cure.
Yeah, I basically think I agree with you. There's one caveat I'll make, but I do want to say that I think one of the things I wanted to say about human sexuality as Freud understood it, as psychoanalysis understands it, is that it's a basic form of opening up to people and opening up onto the world and into human relations. And what you call empathy and empathic relations between people is I think, exactly the stuff of human sexuality from a psychoanalytic point of view. The only thing I wanted to, I want to worry about here is also to say it's crucial to understanding human beings from a psychoanalytic point of view that we have to worry about what the transference is. And sometimes I worry about therapists thinking they're empathic, they understand their patient, when in fact they're just inflicting their own sense of what's going on the patient. And I think empathy can be misused as well as used well.
Glenn is the last caller. Can you be quick, Glenn?
I'll be as brief as I can. I'd be interested in Mr. Lear's definition of happiness. Somewhere I recall Socrates saying happiness is a goal for pigs, and I assume from that he wasn't particularly fond of what we could call a superficial vision of happiness.
Jonathan, what is your vision of happiness?
Well, I want to say I'm going to leave that as a $64,000 question. It's a very, very complicated story, but I will say, end with this. Socrates, when he said happiness was that he was constructing a city for pigs, it wasn't an entirely negative criticism. He thought more highly of pigs than we do.
Jonathan Lear, this is fascinating. I wish we could do this once a week. The doctor is in. We'll straighten out everybody's heads toward happiness. Thank you, and thank you for the book.
You're so welcome.
Happiness, Death, and the Remainder of Life. We didn't get to the remainder of life, but that's the remainder of the connection.
Nice to leave it left over.
Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website at theconnection.org. Thanks for help today from John Hoder, Tim Monroe, Darren Manoogian, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Sarah Field, Dan First, Hitesh Hatti, Amy McDonald, Jake Shapiro, Keith Shields, and Will Smith. Mary McGrath is our analyst. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.